We've been saying from day one there's been no evidence of Trump-Russia collusion, and nothing in the indictment today changes that at all.
But the George Papadopoulos agreement is about the campaign. It is specifically about the campaign.
It has nothing to do with the activities of the campaign. It has to do with his failure to tell the truth. That doesn't have anything to do with the campaign or the campaign's activities.
But it is the clearest evidence yet of ties between the Trump campaign and Russian officials. So.
Again, there are no activities or official capacity in which the Trump campaign was engaged in any of these activities. Most of them took place well before the campaign ever even existed.
White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders speaking with reporters today. Money laundering, lying, tax evasion, 12 counts in all. Donald Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, the first big fish caught in Robert Mueller's investigation. His colleague, a man named Rick Gates, also indicted. Separately, another Trump campaign advisor, George Papadopoulos, has pleaded guilty to perjury for lying to the FBI. It is a big day in the Russia investigation. Josh Meyer is senior investigative reporter for Politico. He's here to break it all down for us. Hi there.
Hi there. How are you?
Well, let's begin with Paul Manafort. What are the most serious charges he's facing?
Well, Paul Manafort surrendered to federal authorities today. He was indicted on charges that he funneled millions of dollars through overseas shell companies and used the money to buy luxury cars, real estate, millions of dollars worth of real estate, antiques, expensive suits. You know, we long suspected that that Manafort might be one of the first people to be charged, along with his longtime associate, Rick Gates, who was also charged, at least in part due to what they did with all of the money that they got from being political consultants in Russia. You might remember that they were paid at least $17 million. The money was found on off the books, binders that were found in Ukraine. And so there were concerns that that he hadn't paid taxes on that, he hadn't declared it, he hadn't filed as a foreign agent under the Foreign Agent Registration Act. So I think the Mueller team is basically starting with the low-hanging fruit, and Manafort and Rick Davis were certainly two of them. That
right.
Doesn't mean that they can't bring more charges later. It's clear that what they're trying to do is sort of, leverage this kind of activity, get people to cooperate, so forth.
Mm-hmm. And what about what we just heard from Sarah Huckabee Sanders, that this has nothing to do with the campaign, that this activity happened all before Manafort joined the campaign? Is that accurate?
It may or may not be. She also was talking about George Papadopoulos, who we will talk about too. I think that her parsing of the charges and very specifically worded responses to it is part of a pattern there. I think she said something about how there wasn't any official activity on the part of the campaign. But, you know, these charges are serious, and I think the Manafort ones and Rick Gates so far don't link to the campaign. But, you know, there are other things that we know in the public domain that do. In fact, for instance, that Manafort reached out to somebody else in his former campaign orbit in Ukraine and said, you know, can we use my visibility here with the campaign to help get us whole in a financial relationship with Oleg Deripaska, who was a and still is a very close Putin associate. He's one of the oligarchs who serves as a sort of unofficial cabinet member for Putin. And right there, I mean, those two connections can lead to much more serious charges if they find wrongdoing.
Okay, let's move on to George Papadopoulos. And he was a campaign advisor, a foreign policy advisor to the campaign. Again, Sarah Huckabee Sanders downplaying his role, saying he was just merely a volunteer. And tell us what he has pleaded guilty to. What did he lie about?
Right. Well, I mean, if you listen to what Sarah Huckabee Sanders has said and you know, Sean Spicer before her, it's almost like there was nobody on the campaign. Almost everybody that the press has asked about has been described as a low-level functionary, including Manafort, who is the campaign chairman. In Papadopoulos' case, it does appear that that actually was the case. I mean, he seemed to be a very low-level foreign policy advisor. He pleaded guilty October 5th to one count of lying to Mueller's FBI agents about the nature of his interactions with, quote, foreign nationals, unquote, who he believed had close connections to senior Russian government officials. So the question there is, what did he believe he was going to get out of those Russian officials? What did he think he was doing to help the Trump campaign? And very importantly, was anybody else in the Trump campaign, involved in those activities? And also, what were the Russians doing to target him? I mean, I've spent a lot of time today doing a profile of Papadopoulos, talking to counterintelligence and counterespionage officials about this, and, you know, at the very least, they say that he is one of those people that's very, very susceptible to what they call a dangle from the Russians, which is, you know, overtures to see if he is interested in cooperating with them, if he's vulnerable, if he's susceptible to blackmail, if there's anything that they can leverage from him in order to sort of help them gain information from the Trump campaign or possible collusion.
Now, he says, or it's in the indictment, that he was offered dirt by the Russians, by this Russian, quote unquote, professor, unnamed
right.
in the indictment, but he's called the professor, and and that this professor has knows that the Russians have dirt on Hillary Clinton. And then he does he then try to connect the campaign to these Russian officials to for this dirt? This would be the so-called collusion.
Yeah, so, I mean, there could be some very plausible explanations for that. I mean, not very good ones for him. I mean, he's in trouble, obviously, for this. And it's clear that the charges are designed to have him cooperate in a much more prolonged investigation. So if he doesn't cooperate, you know, who knows what might happen. But, you know, I mean, you have to remember at the time this was happening, you know, there were, you know, I believe it, you know, sometime around then, you know, the president himself was calling on Russia to help find Hillary Clinton's email. So he may have been one of those people, you know, sort of like Donald Trump Jr., who was really trying to make the boss happy, the candidate, by helping get information about, you know, Hillary Clinton that would help the campaign. I mean, Sarah Sanders Huckabee said that. Huckabee Sanders said that today, too, about how, you know, all campaigns try to get opposition research. In this case, though, it, you know, the line between aggressively pursuing opposition research and colluding with Russian agents is a very, very thin one. So we'll have to see, you know, what else they have on him. I wish I knew.
I'm sure we'll be finding out a lot more in the days and weeks ahead. Josh Meyer,
about the professor. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Josh Meyer, senior investigative reporter for Politico. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Okay, let's look at the legal side of these charges. It's Monday, so Jessica Levinson is here, Loyola Law Professor and our resident legal. Hello.
Hello. If only there were legal news today.
If only. Just a slight ripple in the legal world. Okay. You've read the indictments, all of them.
Yes.
And how serious do you think these indictments are?
Let's just take a step back and say you've read the indictments when it comes to campaign affiliates of the current president or people who were, for instance, served as the campaign manager of the current president, that this shouldn't be a normal sentence that we utter.
Right.
So, yes, I've read the indictments. And what's our takeaway? I mean, our takeaway is that this, I think it's important to understand what this is not. This does not indicate that President Trump or his campaign was involved in Russian interference with the 2016 election. And we keep using the word collusion. But collusion is actually a legal term of art that has a specific meaning in antitrust law. So when Robert Mueller is looking to see whether there is Russian interference and whether or not the Trump campaign was amenable to that interference, we're looking at other specific statutes dealing with, for instance, like honest services fraud, computer hacking, bank fraud, election law violations. So what does this tell us about Manafort and Gates? Well, that a grand jury thought that there was at least probable cause that they've committed federal crimes. And these are people, again, who had high positions in the Trump campaign. It doesn't show us and it doesn't indicate that there is certainly a link between the Trump campaign and Russia. It's another part of the narrative. And frankly, today, I don't think there was a world in which Robert Mueller was going to indict the campaign manager of the Trump administration and was going to show for sure that there was some link between mm-hmm. Russia and the Trump campaign. That's not how these things work. We've moved from the political realm very strongly into the legal realm, and now a whole new paradigm comes down on us. And we're talking about evidentiary rules. We're talking about, again, federal indictments, documents that are sealed. And so this is a new accelerated realm.
So in this instance, would you expect Robert Mueller to bring this indictment against Manafort and Gates? And even though it has nothing to do with, at this point, so-called collusion or so-called, you know, back and forth between the Trump campaign and the Russians, for him to use these indictments to get him to start singing, if you will, because he in the indictment, it talks about forfeiture of assets, a significant amount of assets, and he could put extraordinary pressure on Paul Manafort.
I think that's exactly right. I think that these indictments, and this isn't to say that they aren't real or that they're frivolous, but I think that the purpose behind them, and we see this in a lot of cases, this in a way is kind of a textbook example of how you undertake a big federal investigation, is you start indicting, to the extent it's permissible and reasonable, the affiliates for unrelated crimes. And you say, do you really want to see the inside of a federal prison? Do you really want to give up all your assets? Well, there's this information that we might like, and it might be great if, you know, we could see fit to give you a little less prison time or to not take all your assets, and then you could give us this information that we're really interested in.
To that, I just want to read one of the charges. It says the two, quote, knowingly and intentionally conspired to defraud the United States by impeding, impairing, obstructing, and defeating the lawful governmental functions of a government agency. That sounds pretty serious, but are they talking about tax evasion and perjury?
Yes, they are. So most of what we're talking about with respect to Manafort and Gates is money laundering and conspiring to commit money laundering, false statements, failure to file certain financial disclosure reports, a lot of problems with respect to their lobbying and their banking transactions, and that they didn't register as working for foreign governments. And so there's a lot of words that sound like treason or sound like, oh my goodness, it's going to be President Pence tomorrow. That's not where we are today.
All right. What about George Papadopoulos? What do you make of that guilty plea and that it's come out today of all days?
Well, I think that is actually more closely related to this issue of Russian involvement and Trump campaign involvement with the Russian government in the 2016 election. So Papadopoulos was a lower level employee, but what he
or a
has,
volunteer or Sarah Huckabee Sanders says.
Exactly. But his he has pled guilty to making misleading or false statements to FBI investigators with respect to when he made contact with this person called the professor, who it looks like has now been identified, but I haven't verified that for sure. And that the professor has said, I have information, I have dirt on Hillary Clinton. And this professor apparently has ties to the Russian government. And Papadopoulos made false statements about when these connections were made. And he basically tried to distance these discussions from when he joined the campaign. And as it turns out, his conversation with the professor, it looks like, was actually closely linked to the fact that he joined the campaign, and that's why the professor was interested in him. So to the extent that we're looking at these issues of interference, this is Russian, potentially Russian government involvement or those affiliated with the Russian government, involvement with the Trump campaign. That's a lot closer than you didn't file your federal tax returns in an appropriate way.
And then the indictment says that he actually emailed campaign officials and higher level campaign officials with this information, so that there was at least some conversation happening, that it wasn't just him on his own meeting with the so-called professor.
Yes. What we're going to see over the next hours and days is the Trump administration trying to say, look, he was just this volunteer and he went rogue. And we're basically going to try and make Papadopoulos sound like a summer intern who didn't know what was going on. And it looks like that just wasn't the case. And there's this, one of my law professors said, everything good in life is found in footnotes. There's this really interesting footnote, too, which involves an email that Papadopoulos sent on to a higher level campaign worker. And it basically says, let's try and make sure that it looks like President Trump isn't involved in this. So there was kind of at least a foreshadowing or understanding that there could be problems down the road. And I think that it absolutely will be the case that Papadopoulos will continue to be involved in this investigation, and they will continue to try and get information from him. Again, this doesn't mean as President Pence tomorrow. It doesn't mean that there was interference between the campaign and the Russian government, that there was an agreement for interference. It means that there's probable cause of bad acting by Manafort and Gates, and that Papadopoulos, who was in some way involved with those affiliated with the Russian government, has made false statements to the FBI.
Okay. It is only Monday, though. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming Coming up, how the 18th century Alien and Sedition Acts figure into today's politics and how one of them could be used to discriminate against any group the government deems a threat. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The past, as they say, is prologue. Those who don't know their history, bound to repeat it. Well, one person who does know his history is Press Play regular Mike Schlitt. He's joining us again to make sure that all our listeners never forget. Hello.
Hello. It's important now more than ever.
To know our history?
Yeah.
So the topic today is what? Fake news, immigrant roundups, foreign meddling in American politics.
Right. There's 1798. There are mind-boggling, terrifying parallels between what was happening then and what's happening now. Fake news was rampant. You had a divided electorate. You had a unpopular, thin-skinned, vain president.
Who was that president?
That was John Adams.
1798. Okay.
Good man. Good president. Uh-huh. But he was thin-skinned.
Okay. What was happening in 1798? What did our government look like?
So in 1798, when we talk about political parties, they were more like local clubs. They're not really party. There's no infrastructure. There's no central committee. There's no like party line being communicated. The thing that's holding it all together is newspapers.
So there was no such thing as so-called objective
journalism.
It was all in a camp.
When we talk about a free and independent press, it's important to remember that newspapers at the beginning of this country were basically party organs. So the notion of fake news and alternative facts has been here since day one.
Hmm.
So when the Constitution was ratified, essentially it was a one-party system, more or less. The Federalist Party was in control. And then those of you who've seen the musical Hamilton know that Thomas Jefferson and James Madison split off from the Federalist Party to start the Republican Party. So you have, in 1798, you have the Federalist Party in power. They control all three branches of government. And you have the upstart Republican Party led by Thomas Jefferson and Madison and others. And interestingly, I don't think we've ever seen this since then, where you have a Federalist president in John Adams and you have a vice president who's a member of the opposition party in Thomas Jefferson.
Okay, so set the scene. We have now figured out what it looks like in the government, which was at that time in Philadelphia, not Washington.
Yeah.
And what was happening out in the rest of the United States?
So you have basically, you have a divided electorate, and you have the Federalist Party is the pro-British party. You have the Republican Party, which is the pro-French party. They're also accused of being Jacobins and radical revolutionaries, where John Adams and the Federalists are being accused of being monarchists and Anglophiles. There's a lot of fear and distrust of foreigners because the United States has become this haven for immigrants, for aliens, you know, fleeing countries where there's revolutions. In France, of course, in Haiti, there's a lot of Irish immigrants, and they're seen as dangerous radicals, enemies of the United States. In the summer of 1798, there is a riot in Philadelphia. Adams' house is attacked.
The president of the United States.
Home is attacked. And so the Federalist Party goes, oh, man, we're in deep trouble. We better do something. And so they control both houses of Congress, and they pass these four very draconian laws, possibly unconstitutional, in which they are sort of asking people to relinquish many of their liberties and their rights in exchange for safety and order. So free speech will go by the wayside in exchange for preserving our national security.
And those four laws,
they are known to those of you who studied it in middle school, the Alien and Sedition Acts.
I remember studying it, but I don't remember what was in those acts.
That's usually
probably
what most
common.
People think. But you need to know.
Thankfully,
because you are
here.
They are very relevant for what we're experiencing today.
All right. Three of the four deal with aliens.
Correct.
One deals with sedition. Let's go through the three alien ones.
Okay. So you have the Alien Naturalization Act, which basically makes non-citizens living in the United States wait longer to become citizens. That waiting period goes from 5 to 14 years.
And the other two?
The other two are the Alien Friends Act and the Alien Enemies Act. And basically, they're essentially saying the same thing, that the executive branch of government, the president himself, has unilateral authority to detain, deport or arrest any non-citizen living in this United States in times of peace, which was hotly contested by the two parties, and in times of war, which interestingly was the only one of those four laws that passed with bipartisan support. And of the four laws, that one is still on the books.
But that was used during the Second World War, right?
Correct.
As the basis for why there was the internment of the Japanese.
Right. That was a basis for a Japanese internment and Supreme Court case, Korematsu versus the United States, which upheld the Japanese internment based on this law.
Which was passed in 1798.
1798, exactly.
All right, that's the alien part.
Yeah.
What about the sedition part?
So the sedition law, now we've dealt with the alien problem, let's get to the citizens who are troublemakers. And it basically says you cannot criticize or make any sort of seditious statements against the president or Congress.
And what would happen if you did say something bad about the president?
You would be tried in a federal court. And there were 25 convictions and people imprisoned. Mostly it was members of the opposition press. There was one guy who was arrested for he was just making drunken comments on the street during a parade when Adams passed by. He was convicted of seditious libel. And interestingly, one Republican congressman who was arrested and imprisoned actually ran for reelection while he was in jail and won. Of course, he couldn't serve for part of his term because he was in jail, so he couldn't go to the Capitol.
Well, Mike, as you say, three of the four are no longer with us in terms of the Alien and Sedition Acts.
Yes.
But there's the one that is still with us today. And I guess when you think about this, when you go back in history and you look at what happened during that time, how does that resonate today for you?
Well, you know, it's the Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. I mean, these are terrifying times. But also, it's like if your car is working, you don't think about how the engine works as much. I certainly don't. When the car's not working as well, you start deconstructing that engine and looking at stuff. I've never had more conversations with people about government, about history. It's a great time to be a history buff. I think people are engaged. Some of them are more enraged. But, you know, these things, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. talked about cycles in American history. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg gave an interview and she said the symbol of this country should not be an eagle. It should be a pendulum because, you know, this experiment in democracy is full of dynamic tension between conflicting rights and privileges. And the Trump election is a reaction to the Obama election. And as we move further in one direction, I think eventually that pendulum will swing in another direction. And I think we have a more informed and engaged electorate than we did 9 months ago, and hopefully our country will survive and flourish. That is my hope.
What is your actual thought?
It's also instructive to know that Jefferson and Adams both thought that the country would never survive even close to this long.
Really?
Yeah. Adams, you know, they corresponded years later, and Adams said something that there's never been a democracy in the world that has not committed suicide, is what he said. And, you know, I'm hopeful. For me personally, I find comfort in these facts of the past to help me navigate the present and potential future. I would not conjecture a guess as to say what's going to happen next, but I feel more comfortable knowing more things, and hopefully you and your listeners will as well.
Hopefully. Mike Schlitt, he's an amateur historian, he's a Press Play regular, and he has a really great podcast. You can check it out wherever you get your podcasts. It's called Early Bird Special. Coming up, why Kevin Spacey's explanation for drunkenly attacking a 14-year-old boy decades ago is angering gay rights leaders. And the author Jason Reynolds is here to talk about his latest novel. It's called Long Way Down, and he'll talk about writing for young people.
I am in the business of growing more empathetic human beings who I hope will also be voracious readers.
YA author Jason Reynolds is here, coming up on Press Play. Yeah. You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Kevin Spacey has been accused of sexually assaulting a minor. Actor Anthony Rapp told BuzzFeed News that Spacey pinned him down on a bed at a party more than 30 years ago. At the time, Rapp was 14 years old. Spacey was 26. Spacey tweeted a response yesterday that included an apology and an announcement. He's gay. Today, Netflix announced that House of Cards, which stars Kevin Spacey, will end after the upcoming sixth season, and that had been rumored for a while. Kim Masters is editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Madeline.
Okay, so this incident happened in 1986. Both Spacey and Rapp were working different shows on Broadway. Spacey invited him to this party at his apartment. Apparently, Anthony Rapp says he was bored because he was a kid and it was all adults. So he went to the room to watch TV, and then he realized everyone had left, and Spacey came into the bedroom and lay on top of him, and Rapp managed to escape. And so he talked to BuzzFeed about this soon after. After Spacey tweeted an apology where he says he now chooses to, he doesn't remember the incident, he says in this right. tweeted apology, but he now chooses to live as a gay man. So what's been the response to all of that today?
I will tell you that that is possibly the most horrible PR move. I mean, I would say, Madeline, I don't know a good answer when you're alleged to have attacked especially a child. But to say I'm a gay man has gone over like a lead balloon, and many people in Hollywood have tweeted, and outside, I'm sure, but, you know, many significant people like George Takei and one another tweeted just saying, what are you talking about? You know, Billy Eichner, why would you, this is not, as Billy Eichner put it, you know, he's actually created the bad way to come out of the closet. And, you know, the feeling among many people, like gay and straight, is like clearly being gay is no more an excuse than being, if a straight man were to say, you know, if Roman Polanski were to have said, I'm sorry I raped that child, I'm a straight man. So, you know, that explains it.
Right.
I mean, it tries to put a burden on the gay community that there is just no way in this world that they should have to bear. But because of history and current, you know, homophobia in the world, I know a lot of people feel very concerned that this is going to create more gay bashing incidents and more, you know, energize a homophobic world that's trying to marginalize people who are gay or, you know, outside the hetero community.
Right, because of course this confirms every vicious stereotype that gay men are predators and pedophiles and threats
to
children.
I mean, I know you don't mean he actually confirms it, but if you want it to confirm it, you will say it confirms it, right?
Right, not confirmed it, but it has illustrated that vicious stereotype. So meanwhile, House of Cards showrunner is Bo Willimon. He has tweeted that this is deeply troubling.
Not to say the least,
yeah.
Right? I think Netflix has a problem on its hands. You know, when the Harvey Weinstein scandal started, people were saying, who is the gay Harvey Weinstein? And there may be more than one, but I can tell you that based on stuff that we are hearing as we report, this is hardly an isolated incident, that Kevin Spacey's pattern of aggressive sexual harassment. You know,
so,
the earth is totally scorched for Harvey Weinstein, and I think it's equally scorched now for Kevin Spacey. And it's a sad thing to see people with talent just self-immolate like this, but, you know, this behavior is not tolerable.
Right. So there have been stories about so-called the other open secret in Hollywood, the abuse of boys by powerful men. Of course, there was the Bryan Singer story a few years ago where
disintegrated, right? That was something that we pursued aggressively at The Hollywood Reporter. And the person making the allegations in that case, you know, they always look in these cases, Harvey Weinstein did it, and they did it. They always look to investigate your past and make you look bad. And in this case, that accuser there was a lot to use. So he disintegrated as a potential witness, and the whole thing fell apart very quickly. He seemed to have made some false allegations against some others. It was a mess, you know. But, you know, that doesn't mean that there was, the smoke means there's, you know, there was still smoke that could mean there's fire.
Right, right. And Corey Feldman is now speaking openly about, he says he was abused. He's trying to make a movie about it. So what is your sense about where this is all headed?
You know, when it started with Harvey, people asked me again and again, do you think this is the turning point? And I felt, you know, that for a story to be a turning point, it has to have what we call legs. You know, it has to keep going. People have to keep coming forward. And I think we are seeing that pattern. I mean, we have numerous accounts, you know, on my show, The Business, this week, two women speak out about their experiences very candidly. People are coming onto the record and telling their stories. Some are still afraid. Some of these people, I think, are still in seats of great power. We are working on stories. It's very, still very difficult for people who are at the height of their power and you know, wealth. But I the story does have legs, so we can hope that this is a turning point and that there will be, I mean, I think right now we're going to see a number of companies and agencies suddenly announce that different executives are leaving to pursue other interests. And I think in many cases that will be code for this person is a harasser and we can no longer have this here because it's too great of a liability. So stuff that's been ignored and or covered up for years, I think people are now going to get very nervous about ignoring and covering up. And I think it's going to end careers.
Mm. And there was something about, oh, well, these are men who were on the decline professionally. You know, Harvey Weinstein was not at the apex any longer. Bill Cosby, same thing. Roger Ailes. That is the one of the reasons why this has come out now, and that the men who are really in seats of power who may have been abusive are immune at the moment. Do you think there's anything to that, or do you think that that's also going to crack?
I am telling you, you know, we're trying to make it crack, and it's not easy right now. I mean, we know who we are looking at, and we know, you know, it's very tough. People, I don't think, understand, you know, getting this stuff on the record is very hard, mm-hmm. getting it into a publishable state. I knew about Harvey, as I've said many times, for more than 20 years. There was nobody coming forward. There was no way to get it publishable. And finally, that changed, you know, and so, yes, Harvey was in decline. The question now is, if this person is still sitting in the job, you know, at the top of the mountain, will anybody dare to come forward? And that's where I think it's going to get, like, less likely. And I hope we have a pleasant surprise, because I think these people need to be exposed, but I'm not sure that we will.
Kim Masters, editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter, also host of KCRW's The Business. Thanks, Kim.
Thank you.
Coming up on the show, the YA author Jason Reynolds is here. His novel is in verse entirely. It takes place on a 5-minute elevator ride in which the main character has to decide whether or not to shoot and kill another Black teenager. That's next on Press Play. A little Queen Latifah on Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. You don't really need a reason to play Queen Latifah. She is appropriate for all occasions. But we have a reason today. We're playing this song because it had a huge influence on the writer we're talking with, Jason Reynolds. Reynolds is a poet and a young adult author. And when he bought the cassette with this song on it, he says it changed his life.
I loved it. I loved it, loved it, loved it. I love the language. And now I'm old enough to see the correlation between a song like Ladies First and Maya Angelou's Phenomenal Woman. I'm able to see how closely connected those are, but they're just a generation apart, right? And that's when I fell in love with it. That's what it was. And so from there, I just wrote poems. I studied poetry in school and in college, and I just was addicted to the idea that I could say so much with so few words. There was such power in that for me.
Jason Reynolds has taken that power and turned it into a number of books, including his latest, Long Way Down. It takes place entirely during one elevator ride. A young man's brother has been killed, and he is contemplating revenge.
The sadness is just so hard to explain. Imagine waking up and someone, a stranger, got you strapped down, got pliers shoved into your mouth, gripping a tooth somewhere in the back, one of the big, important ones, and rips it out. Imagine the knocking in your head, the pressure pushing through your ears, the blood pooling. But the worst part, the absolute worst part, is the constant slipping of your tongue into the new empty space where you know a tooth is supposed to be, but ain't no more.
Jason Reynolds reading from his new book, Long Way Down. It's written entirely in verse. The words are sparse, arranged artistically on the page. It's really a captivating experience.
I wanted everything in the book to mimic what this young person is feeling and what young people feel who deal with this kind of trauma and this sort of violence, right? And what that feeling is, there's coldness, there is like the feeling of steel being trapped in a very small space, the movement of an elevator, the shaky movement of an elevator, the vertigo that takes place in an elevator. All of these are mimicking sort of what it feels like to experience this kind of trauma. The same goes with the poetry. How can I sort of show the poetry in the exact same way? How can I use the shape of the poetry to mimic the elevator and to mimic the mind? That's why you, like, the shapes are there. That's why even the way that the language is set up on the page, most of it is pretty slim, like an elevator. Even sort of figuring out ways to use language to show the way that the mind works instead of writing in complete sentences, right? Because the brain doesn't work in complete sentences. We like to pretend that it does. And we put it on the page as if it does. But the truth is that the brain works more like poems, right? It works in like sort of sharp, snappy codes, right? It's firing off in your brain that we sort of put together to create the reality around us, right? And so that's the reason that I chose poetry and that I chose the elevator. I think it's all just meta, basically.
Right. I mean, you describe it as a vertical coffin.
Yep. I mean, I think that's what it is, though. Yeah, we don't talk about it that way because we don't die. We're not in it dying, yeah. You know. Though some of us feel like we're going to die, but I do think that an elevator is, to describe an elevator as a vertical coffin, I think it's an accurate description.
Yeah, well, you know, and your character Will, he is possibly riding this elevator to his death.
Absolutely, I think, you know, that's the beauty of poetry. And this is like, I guess that's like the other thing about why choose verse. You have so much space to use metaphor and analogy. You have so much freedom to create layers in a way that you can also do with prose. But it just feels like you're supposed, like with poetry, it feels like you're supposed to reread the book. It feels like there are several different ways that you could sort of experience this moment with this young person. And the truth is that there are multi-levels and multi-layers. Every single thing in the book is coded and symbolic. And I did that intentionally. And I think that in and of itself is the power of verse.
Mm. You are talking to teenagers, right, in your writing?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I look at that as a privilege, right? It's an honor. It's an honor. I am of service to our youth. I think that who else is there to write for if we are not talking to our children, right? And at the end of the day, we have an opportunity. I myself have an opportunity and a responsibility to grow readers. And not just grow readers, but to grow more empathetic human beings. And that is the business that I am in, right? I am in the business of growing more empathetic human beings who I hope will also be voracious readers.
Let's talk about your character, Will. And he's a 15-year-old, and his brother has just been shot and killed. And he has decided that he needs to follow the rules. And the rules are that you need to exact your revenge. And even though he's never really picked up a gun before, he finds his brother's gun. And he decides to get on an elevator and go find his brother's killer and take care of him. And your entire novel is that elevator ride down.
Yep.
And tell me more about Will and the conflict that he's undergoing in that elevator.
Will is a young person who, like so many young people, who live in communities that have specific ecosystems. And I think this is the thing that so many people outside of these communities don't quite understand. I think that it's easy for so many of us to wag our fingers from the outside the fishbowl, but on the inside of that fishbowl, there are rules, there are codes, there's an ecosystem, there's a way that things function, there's a pathology. And I think that Will is a product of that and is trying to follow the rules that have been set far before he was born. He doesn't quite understand them, but he knows that they're there to be followed, especially in moments of pain and trauma. But who Will really is a young person who is afraid and who is in pain, but is uncertain of what the other options are in order to get that fear and pain exorcised. Right. And I think so he does what he thinks he's supposed to do. He does what so many before him, what he watched and heard and seen so many before him do, mm-hmm. which is follow the rules. Just follow the rules. It's the way the community works. But in reality, you know, Will could be any kid. You know, I put Will in this particular situation because this is a situation that I think should be addressed. But the truth is that we could put Will in a lot of different situations, right? Will could also just as easily be the young kid who watches as an instance of brutality and has to make a decision of if he's going to mind his business, which is the rule, or if he's going to speak out about it. We could put Will in a situation with a young lady who is being mistreated, and Will has to make a decision. Does he follow the rules that have been set by a toxic community or perhaps toxic rules that have been set by a complex community, or does Will do something otherwise? We could put him in any situation because every situation has a set of rules. Mm-hmm. And usually those rules at some point are going to become complicated. Yeah. And you're going to have to figure out, do you bend them? Do you break them? Like, what are the moves that you make? So.
But they're particularly dire in this instance because they are about life and death. And it right. seems like the rules were written in kind of almost in a war mentality, like these are the rules in order to survive, that you have to live by these rules. And, you know, they're not technically at war, but I guess in reality, they are.
Sure. Sure. And I think the truth is that these codes have existed in real life for a very, very long time. Like, I didn't make those rules up. Those are actual rules, mm-hmm. right? That's the way it actually is in so many low-income Black and brown communities who are dealing with these issues. Like, those rules have existed for decades, mm-hmm. for decades, right? It's that's been the code. And you're right. It is life or death, which is what makes it so difficult for the young people who are in these situations, because for them, either way, it's life or death, right? Yeah. So either I'm going to follow the rules and risk my life, or I'm going to not follow the rules and risk my life. And I think that's the tricky part, you know.
One of the rules is no crying. And I just found that particularly poignant because several times he wants to and he can't because he's got to follow the rules. But he's only a kid.
Yeah,
he's only a kid. His brother, whom he really looked up to.
Yeah. I mean, you know, no crying is sort of, to me, I mean, here's the thing. If we talk about these rules and we talk about gun violence and we talk about these young people who are dealing with all the things that they're dealing with in these particular situations, we obviously have to take the micro and make it macro, right? We have to sort of look at what's happening. And before we sort of judge the young people, we have to look at all the other circumstances, like the codes, the rules, the community. We have to look at poverty, education, government, politics, all of this stuff. The other thing that we have to look at, though, as a society, literally is distilled down to those two words, no crying. There is a real issue when it comes to this idea of toxic masculinity, this idea that young men are not allowed to be human beings. They aren't allowed the luxury of humanity because we have all been trained to believe that to be a man, to be masculine, means to be cold as ice, means to be emotionless. To be strong means to be tearless, to be waterless, right? And I think that it is in that you find, to me at least, my opinion is that so many issues and so many problems in our society comes from the fact that young men have no idea what it actually means to be a human being, that the part of them that is necessary in every situation, compassion and empathy and warmth, unfortunately has been socialized out of them from a very young age. Every time a boy falls on the ground, somebody picks him up and says, you're okay, when they should be asking, are you okay? Hmm. And letting that boy say, no, I want to cry. And then allowing him the space to be fully human. If not, it will come out. It is going to come out one way or another. Whether he's 30 years old and he's punching somebody, whether he's 16 years old and he's breaking the wall, whether he's 40 and he's doing drugs, whatever it is, right? Like, toxic masculinity is just what it sounds like. It is toxic. It is poisoning us, not just men. It is poisoning an entire society, and I'd argue even the majority of Earth. And so, I mean, you know, no crying. No crying is a rule. And not just a rule in these environments. It's a rule all over the world.
Yeah.
It's insane. And I just think we have to do better.
Do you cry a lot?
As often as I can. As often as possible, I step to the side, take a moment, and get it out.
Did you have to learn to do that?
You know, my family was okay with it. My father, on the other hand, he was raised not to cry. And I think because of that, he made sure that it was okay for us to get it out. My father always used to tell us a story about how at his brother's funeral, his brother died in the Vietnam War. I think he was like 19 or 20 years old. And my father was, I think, 14, 13. And at his funeral, my grandfather said, "No crying." And my father hasn't cried maybe since then. Mm. Wow. You know, like, I mean, my father is 67 years old, I think. And he doesn't remember the last time that he's actually cried. He said he doesn't know if he can do it. He doesn't know if he can physically cry. Mm. And he didn't want us to be that way, so.
You're lucky.
I am.
Well, Jason Reynolds, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Jason Reynolds, his latest book is called Long Way Down. Okay, and Christian Bordahl is here now with some listener feedback.
Yes, hey there, Madeline. Well, first, let's start with the important news. The Dodgers lost last night.
Yes.
In a game that was completely insane in the membrane. It was so crazy. They lost 13-12. It was a crazy, crazy game. And let's talk about slick baseballs. Okay.
Okay.
Slick baseballs. Pitchers and coaches from both the Dodgers and
Astros.
Slick,
you're talking about.
Slick, yes. They say the baseballs they're using in the World Series have a different grain to the leather that's slicker than usual, and that benefits the hitters because the pitchers can't get as much spin on the baseball. So, in any case, the Dodgers...
Is there a conspiracy?
There could be a conspiracy.
Where are these baseballs made? Are they made
Costa Rica.
In Texas?
Okay. Anyway, they have their backs to the wall. Tomorrow night, the Dodgers are going to have to win. And if they do, then it's all down to Wednesday for a Game 7. Very, very...
Which will be here.
It will. They're both here. Yep. Tomorrow and Wednesday.
Okay.
Very exciting. In other news, you may have heard about this guy, Paul Manafort, being indicted today on a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, we heard that.
Money laundering.
I think I heard something along those lines.
Anyway, the big question, obviously, is was there collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia? And Trump says, no, there's no collusion. Press play listener Lavana Atkinson-Williams says, if Trump is awake and speaking or tweeting, he's lying. Salomon Pereira says, lock him up, lock him up. Art Gardner says, the indictment says, through at least 2016. In other words, it wasn't long ago, the way President Trump has said. Anyway, I posted another of my scientifically rigorous Twitter polls on this issue. 5% say, no way, no collusion. 87% say, yes way. And 88% of cooler heads say the jury is still out. So there you have it. That's okay. What our listeners think.
All right. And how many people weighed in? Can you tell from that poll?
I can tell from that poll. It's 170.
Okay. Purely scientific poll. Okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
You're
Christian
welcome.
Bordahl. Have a great rest of your day,
you
evening,
too.
Whatever. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.